Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. I guess we're starting the podcast.
I guess we're starting the podcast. Welcome,
that's
everybody.
That's Ben Sternke, and I'm Matt
Tebbe. And that's Matt
Tebbe. And you are welcomed to the podcast by the both of us.
You are.
Happy Eastertide, Ben.
You as well, Matt. I enjoy Eastertide. Listener, if you're not familiar with that word, it just refers to the season of Easter. Easter is a whole season. It's not just a day.
Yeah.
It's 50 days of feasting and rejoicing, celebration, all the way to Pentecost Sunday.
This is something that I think those of us who spent a lot of time in what's normally considered a lower church experience, they miss the fact that Christmas is 12 days long and Easter is 50.
Right.
And I don't know. It's hard to party for 50 days straight.
It really is exhausting.
For a 47-year-old. But
the older you get.
I'm going to give it a try. Yeah. We're recording this on the day of the eclipse that everyone is losing their minds about. And I'm pretty excited to check it out.
I am excited myself, yeah. I'm tracking the weather. I mean, it looks, we're recording this in the morning, and the weather looks fairly clear here in Indianapolis. And so, of course, the eclipse, it's a big deal here in Indianapolis because we are in the path of total depravity. I think that's what it's called.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's called the path of totality. little theology joke for you. But yeah, we're in the path of totality. And so there was actually last Sunday in church, there's a lot of family members in town, who were like, oh, I'm here for the eclipse. And I decided to accompany my family member to church. So anyway, we've heard, I don't know, I've heard all kinds of numbers. I've heard anywhere from like 100,000 to 300,000 extra people in Indianapolis, this weekend and today for this event, for this eclipse.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's not going to be cloudy.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Well, hopefully you're all here, you know. I met a nice guy on Reddit who told me if I gave him my social security number, he would transfer $55 billion in Bitcoin into my offshore bank account.
Did you not take him up on that? You should have taken him up on that.
No. I was about to, and then Sharon was like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Hey, we've got a book giveaway to announce.
That's right.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. A couple of weeks ago, we announced that we were giving away a copy of Michael Rhodes' book, Just Discipleship, and several of you entered, which is fun. And so we're in partnership with IVP, who published the book. We are excited. We thought we'd give a couple of weeks just for people to enter and listen to the podcast episode. And we are excited to mention that the winners are... you can find this tab on my browser here. We picked the winners. I mean, we didn't hand select them. We put them into a random winner picker. And the winners are Gail Rinesmith and Jennifer Kurtz. So congratulations to the both of you for winning a copy of Michael Rhodes' book. It was kind of fun to do a book giveaway. I think we should do that again in the future.
We should. Congratulations. I think I know Jennifer, but I don't know the other person. So it's a good book. You'll love it.
Congratulations, everybody.
And speaking of books, we're talking to Alicia Kaufman today. She's a historian at Baylor who's written a book called Turning Points in American Church History, How Pivotal Events Shape a Nation and a Faith. You know, I'm reminded again, my son's 15 and he's in he's a freshman in high school and his favorite class is AP World History. It's his hardest class, but it's also his favorite because of how fascinating history can be. Just how so interesting watching a drama that's distant to us, you know, in a different time, a different place, different people that we know, how they're, what they're dealing with and interacting with this can shed light on us today and help us understand and know ourselves better. Yeah. And that's what Alicia does in this book.
Yeah. I think this kind of thing has been so helpful for me in my, my faith journey. Even though it's been, I was just reflecting on how I wasn't on this interview. And so, I don't know exactly what y'all talked about, but I think just the intersection of history and faith and theology, initially was quite disorienting for me to, realize, cause I think I grew up with this naive assumption that like what I believed about God was just sort of like taken straight from the Bible and was just like, I don't know, was just like objectively from the Bible. And it was disorienting for me initially to realize that the way that my tradition interpreted the Bible was influenced by historical events and political interests and, you know, all kinds of things that didn't necessarily have to do with what is the truth about God. Like there were other questions going on and reasons why this belief about God felt true to people, you know, when this, when these beliefs were being developed and why it was convenient for them to believe this about God and all that kind of thing. So initially very disorienting because I was like, is any of this true? And you know, that kind of a thing. But I think, thankfully, I think I was able to weather that storm and, you know, and come to, I guess just appreciate the way that historical forces have, influenced and shaped the way that theology develops, and all of that kind of thing. But also just to retain, I think for me anyway, a belief in the fact that the Holy Spirit is, present in all of those things. And we can still discern, you know, maybe how those, political forces and historical events influenced the way that we think about our faith, but also, you know, still trust that God's at work, in the midst of history. And maybe help us see how maybe the events of our own time are affecting the way that we think about our faith today. So anyway, I'm grateful for historians like Alicia.
Me too.
Who can help us with that stuff.
Yeah, we should get into it.
Let's do it. Here we go.
Dr. Alicia Kaufman joins us today on the Gravity Podcast. She's Associate Professor of History at Baylor University and the author of several books, including The Christian Century and the Rise of the Protestant Mainline, and Margaret Mead, A 20th Century Faith. We're talking to her today about her new book, Turning Points in American Church History, How Pivotal Events Shaped a Nation and a Faith. Alicia, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm really, really glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I think you grew up just up the road from us. I live in Fishers, Indiana. Did you grow up like in Upland?
I grew up in Upland. That's exactly right.
All right. So the first question to get out of the way, what's your favorite Ivanhoe's milkshake?
There's so many.
Insider baseball here.
There's a Heath Bar one that I was partial to, but the blueberry cheesecake one, also very good.
Oh my gosh. Chrissy, did you go there? You were at Taylor recently. Yeah.
Every time I go there to speak, that is a stop I make. And I get a different one every time.
Yeah.
You know, people can like check them off or something. You get, I don't even know what you get, a t-shirt or something.
Like a scorecard or something.
Yeah. And there's no way cool. I'll ever make it, but anyway, like it's a, cool. They're super yummy.
You probably get a pharmacy discount card from, you know, all the medical conditions that come.
It was all about report cards when I was growing up, because you could get a free mini sundae or mini shake with a good report card, which was never exactly defined. And when I was home from grad school, I was bringing in my Duke report card and explaining that, yes, these weird letters, they are classes. This is a report card. Give me my clown sundae.
Yes, that's awesome. Doing really well, please. Yes, yes.
That's amazing.
That is fascinating. The only people I've, you know, most people have heard of Upland or have been in Upland because they were students at Taylor. I've never heard of anybody who grew up in Upland. Well, like 12 people in that town, right?
About 2,000. It's growing now.
Oh, it
They're
is.
Putting houses across the street from my parents. Oh. We were on the edge of town, meaning that there were houses on our side of the street and a cornfield on the other side of the street. And now there's houses on both sides of the street, and it's just mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, Alicia, you mentioned your report card. I just to talk about my report card a little bit here. I remember when I fell in love with history in high school. My history teacher in high school taught me how to write, and she taught me how to think. Mrs. Damon was her name. And then I remember when I decided to major in history in college, I was in a conservatory of music, and I had to take one class outside of the conservatory, that academic, and it was a history class, and I loved it better than all my music classes. And that's when I knew I had to change majors and major in history. So I got a BA in history, and I read it all the time now. I love history. How did you come to find yourself in a vocation where you have to do history for a living?
It took me a lot longer to get there than it took you. My high school history was the more typical coaches who had to teach something. And so it was history, only if there was a big game coming up, they weren't focused on what they were teaching at all. I thought I hated history in high school. I took the absolute minimum in college. I was in English literature and literature major and communications minor. I was doing journalism. And so it was right after college, I was working at Christianity Today Publishing, not at CT Magazine, but at the website, which was brand new in the late 90s. One of the projects over in the online services department was putting, I think it was either 40 or 50 issues of Christian History Magazine, which was one of the magazines they published, onto a CD-ROM, which was cutting-edge technology at the time. And they didn't have digital files of the old issues. They just had the physical copies. And so they were scanning and doing OCR, and that's how they were going to get the content onto the CD-ROM. But it was riddled with errors, especially because in the early years, for some reason, they would often print orange type on a lighter orange page. It was almost impossible to read. So the OCR was all over the place. So I was just reading issue after issue after issue of Christian History Magazine just to copy edit it, and realizing that I had never been taught church history at all. And it was really interesting, and it was really challenging, and it was really eye-opening that Christianity wasn't just the form that I had learned in a tiny town in central Indiana, and then at one Christian college in the Chicago suburbs, that there had been all kinds of Christians over time who read the Bible differently, who structured their churches differently, who interacted with other cultures differently. And so then when an editorial job at Christian History Magazine came open, I switched over to that. I'd also been at Campus Life, the teen magazine, briefly. And it was editing Christian History Magazine on the strength of my BA in English literature and saying, I should probably know a little bit more about this subject. So I went back down the street to Wheaton to take just a couple, three graduate church history classes, and then decided before my GRE scores expired that I would apply to grad school and see if maybe I would be a professor instead. So that's how I got into it. It was after undergrad.
That's so cool.
That's super fun. Well, you wrote this book and it has 13 chapters on 13 pivotal moments, and we're going to really focus on two of those chapters in a minute. But can you first tell us, like, how did you select these stories that comprise this book? Like, what qualifies something as pivotal?
Yeah. So the book is modeled on one by one of my mentors, Mark Knoll, who was one of those people when I went back down the road from Christianity Today back to Wheaton to take a graduate class. That was when I took his church history class. And he used a book that he had just written that was turning points in church history, all of it, like Acts forward. That was how he structured the semester. I think that book came out in 1997. It's been in print ever since. It's fourth edition now. So for him, I think the turning points, even though it was a much bigger sweep of history, they were a little bit easier to identify. I started thinking about a turning points book for just American church history at my previous teaching job at a seminary up in Dubuque, Iowa, where every fall I had to teach early and medieval church history in one semester. And then every spring it was Reformation, modern Europe, and U.S. in 12 weeks total.
Whoa.
And so I wanted a book that I could do American church history, like a credible job of American church history in about 2 weeks of a semester. 2.5 was the most I could give it. And I remembered the Turning Points book from Mark's class thinking that format would work really well here and then also be something that my seminary students could maybe use out in their ministry. But there wasn't a Turning Points in American church history book. So I talked to the publisher, Baker Academic. Are there plans to have, you know, franchise of this? Are there going to be more Turning Points books? They didn't have any plans to do it. So that then morphed into, well, would you want to write this book? So I started writing it back when I was at University of Dubuque Theological Seminary and wasn't able to finish it till here. And I started just by calling Mark Knoll on the phone and saying, so if you were going to do a Turning Points book just for American church history, what turning points would you put on there? And so I was jotting down notes from that conversation. And then when it got time to actually plan out how long is the timeline going to be, what dates can I put so they're relatively evenly spaced rather than having a whole century that I didn't have any and then five all bunched together. So some of my turning points are more like launch points, the beginning of institutional Roman Catholicism in the United States or the beginning of Pentecostalism rather than an inflection point in a storyline that was already going. So mine are a bit more of a mixed bag, not necessarily turning points, but some event that I could focus in on and be able to give some of the historical context, multiple interpretations of what was going on. So you can still get through it quickly, but you don't kind of feel like you're just floating on the surface and getting a tiny bit of information about absolutely everything under the sun.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot in your book, and we don't have time to really dive into all of it. So we're going to kind of focus on two of them. But one of them is the Methodist split. And so tell us, why did you pick this as a pivotal moment in U.S. church history?
Right. And we mean the Methodist split over slavery before the Civil
yes,
War.
Yes, sorry. Right. Yep, yep.
The more recent one, unfortunately. Yeah. Yeah, if you're going to do an American history or American church history, the Civil War is going to be in there. That is the big hinge point in U.S. history. And from a church history standpoint, the church splits before it are a good way to get into that. This chapter very much follows a different book by Mark Knoll, The Civil War is a Theological Crisis. And that was one that I read early in my graduate education and really helped me see that things that I thought were more recent, specifically different ways of understanding the Bible and seemingly just intractable differences when Christians, Protestant Christians specifically, read the Bible. And one group thought it very clearly said one thing, and a different group thought it just as equally clearly said something else. Protestants don't really have any way of adjudicating that. So the Civil War was not caused because Protestants couldn't adjudicate their Bible interpretation, but that two big approaches to the Bible emerged from that early 19th century period. You find one verse that seems to really specifically talk about what you want, slaves obey your masters, or you take a more holistic approach. Yeah, the Bible says that one thing, but I don't think that's really what God means for humanity. If you look at everything Genesis to Revelation, if you look at everything that we understand about Scripture and God and humanity, one verse says slaves obey your masters, but holistically, the Bible and Christianity is against slavery. And then those big interpretive approaches get applied to lots of other issues as well, including the one that has most recently split the Methodist Church about LGBTQ recognition.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Let's get back to the show. This is why I was so keen to talk to you, Alicia, is because I think we often have such a limited perspective, and we think that the things we're battling over today are new or novel. And what the reason I liked how you picked the Methodist split in 1844, and then you talked about the Presbyterians and then the Baptists, how that sort of, and then in that chapter, you say how people who were watching that happen said, well, how are the politicians going to get along if the Christians can't even do it over slavery? So they were sort of like these precursors or early signposts that this whole thing was going to blow up. But what I love about it is, and you just referenced this, is that the hermeneutic that was being fought over about slavery is still being fought over today. There are still people that read in a literal proof texting way, and then there's other people that read in a more like, let's take all of this together and what's the trajectory or what's the holistic picture here. Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. And I had maybe gotten a vague sense that that was from the so-called fundamentalist modernist split of the early 20th century. But then to see from Noel's book, no, it was earlier than that. It was over a different issue than I thought it was. And I felt like I could understand better the disagreements of later periods, seeing how they played out over the slavery issue in the early 1800s.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about then because you move from the Methodist split, North and South, into the Civil War. And then coming out of the Civil War, you talk about, maybe before I say that, There's an interesting part in this chapter about how both the North and the South are using the concept of freedom, but they're using it in different ways, almost to refer to opposite realities. Like one is talking about freeing enslaved people, and the other side is talking about the freedom to enslave. Can you talk about this phenomenon, and how do you understand how we can get so backwards and sideways over a word like freedom?
I guess in some senses, whatever the key words, the important words of a tradition or a place are, everybody's going to find a way to use that because those are the ones that carry some weight. Those are the ones that work well as slogans. And of course, both the Northern and Southern approaches leading up to the Civil War were deeply American. They had the same constitution. They had the same history. They could appeal to the same principles in certain ways. Are we talking about the freedom to choose with whom you were going to associate, which leads to racial segregation, or the freedom of every individual to go anywhere they want to, which leads to breaking down segregation? These principles embedded in the constitution can be used, have been used both ways. And then Christian principles, Christian language could also be used both ways for whatever sort of social order people wanted to uphold. They could find very nice sounding political slogans or very powerful sounding theological concepts to bolster the case they wanted to make anyway.
Hmm. We see this today. Yeah. I mean, double click on that. Like, where do you see this showing up today?
Religious freedom gets used in various ways right now. I find it often very bothersome when religious freedom is declared by institutions as because of our religious freedom, we get to make these rules that discriminate against women or LGBTQ individuals or people from outside the country. And I always cheer for the, unfortunately, comparatively rare stories on the other side. Right now, there's a ministry in South Texas that has been part of welcoming and helping migrants that is getting cracked down upon by the state. Like, if you want to have religious freedom as a principle, let's use it for that, not just, and that's why we don't have to have, we don't have to allow our employees to use birth control or something. When religious freedom is mostly a principle that imposes more rules, that's the way the language is used now, but I don't like it. I don't like it when the language is used that way.
Yeah. Yeah. You talk about how in the Civil War, both sides saw their cause as like a holy war. And I actually grew up Catholic here in Indiana, Alicia. I grew up singing the Battle Hymn of the Republic in my Catholic church. Mm-hmm. And when I sang it as a kid, I had no idea it was from the Civil War. It's a really catchy tune. I mean, it's in terms of all the old hymns, it's really catchy. But I wonder how you, and then post-Civil War, you talk about how civil religion, kind of around each other's causes. Could you talk about those two civil religions and if they do and how they do endure today?
Yeah. And here I'm drawing on some more scholarship. A book like this that's ranging all the way from the defeat of the Spanish Armada to the election of Ronald Reagan. I am not an expert in all of those things. I'm drawing on other scholarship, Aristotle's Upon the Altar. I'm getting the title wrong, but Moral History of the Civil War, that gets pulled in here a lot. Yeah, for both North and South, it was this, it was a total war from a military standpoint. This is like burning cities to the ground kind of war, which we had not had within the United States before that. We had, American settlers had done that to Native populations. They had not done it to each other. It was a total war and a holy war. So there's no limit. No violence is too much. No number of deaths is too many because the cause is ultimate. And so it leads to obviously really devastating things happening, things that Americans in a more sober moment, you would think, no, they would never do that. They would never stand for that. Well, they did that and they did put up with it and they pressed through. And all of these sacrifices mounting up then creates a need to rationalize it even more. Those sacrifices cannot be in vain. It has to be for, again, this ultimate holy cause, their understanding of who God is and how God interacts with the world and what constitutes a godly life gets all bound up in that, ratcheted up as high as it could possibly go. And then the war ends and one side won and the other one lost. And the winners in the North create a civil religion. There's an image that I used in the book of
a powerful image.
Washington welcoming Lincoln up to heaven and crowning him. Like these are godlike figures to the North. And then you get the religion of the lost cause in the South, that the Confederate leaders were such great godly men and we must put up statues to them and we must teach our children about how great and godly the South during slavery was. The slaves were so happy. They were learning Christianity. Like, you have to come up with a theology, a philosophy to justify what just happened and to make your peace with the fact that you lost. And it gets really dangerous and, again, really, really totalizing. And you can see a lot of the religion of the lost cause. Confederate monuments have finally come down in the last 5 years. They were put up not right after the Civil War. They were put up later in the 1800s, early 1900s. Most of the schools were renamed after Confederate leaders right after school integration was declared by the Supreme Court, invoking and imagining the lost cause and the wonderful godly South got used any time, particularly Southern Christians felt like they were under attack. They wanted to assert themselves. There's a lot of religion of the lost cause in the Southern strategy of the Republican Party in the 1970s. There's a lot of in our political rhetoric today. They are looking down on you. You need to defend your godly society. That is lost cause religion, and it comes out of the Southern losing side of the Civil War.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, I don't know if you're familiar with Heather Cox Richardson's How the South Won the Civil War.
Yep.
Such a powerful book that traces sort of that ideology and how it continues to reinvent itself and reemerge in different political movements, different and in different geographies too, like in the West later in the 19th century, et cetera. And I thought about that as I read this chapter, that how not only is lost cause ideology alive and well, but many people who believe lost cause myths think it's history. And so this is one of the reasons why, Alicia, what you're doing is so important, is because we can actually read firsthand accounts of how slaves were treated. We can actually read firsthand accounts of enslavers feeling a little twinge in their conscience that maybe they shouldn't be raping their slaves. Like, we can actually read what happened, you know? And so that's why history is so important.
We can read the declarations of secession. I'll occasionally get students down here in Texas saying the Civil War was about states' rights. Okay, states' rights to what? And also, when they seceded, what did they say the reason was? We can take their word. You don't have to take my word for it. We can take their word for it. They were very clear in what this was about.
Yes. 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 Well, let's move to chapter, I think it's 11, which is on the Scopes trial, which is also sometimes called the Scopes monkey trial, right? You trace, in the beginning of this chapter, I thought it was fascinating. You trace, you have this little anecdote about how the West came into contact with Aristotle. And I wonder as an appetizer to talking about this trial in 1925, if you can share how the West lost Aristotle and what happened when the Christian West sort of rediscovered him.
Wow, I did not expect you to ask me about that part. So one of the things I was doing in this chapter, again, it came out of my previous job when I taught all the church history surveys at a seminary. Mm-hmm. And so there were things that would come up, like in the early medieval church history part. And I was imagining my seminary students. This was a callback for something that they would have gotten in the fall semester church history survey. Someone coming to this book not expecting that is going to be like, why do we have this very deep history of science and religion? The West, the Roman Empire falls into decline. There's the rise of Islam, and Islamic scholars had much more scholarship and libraries and kept the classic Greek thinkers. And then through the Crusades, and then eventually the Christian reconquest of Europe, Christian European scholars are reintroduced to these texts. They get them in translation. Sometimes they'll engage with Muslim scholars. It wasn't like there were these great interfaith conferences happening for the most part. There were a lot of fraught ways of interacting. But yes, the West in the medieval period is reintroduced to what then gets rebranded as the Great Western Tradition, as if we always had it and we did not. thinking about how do you know what's true, what's real? And I would have taught my first semester seminary students my very crude diagrams of Plato and Aristotle. And for Plato, is the truth what is out there? You can never see it. You only see sort of a shadow of it, but the real truth is unchanging somewhere out there. Or do we really know what's real mostly by observing it? Are we moving from the little particular observations to bigger principles and theories rather than imagining the theories and trying to work the other way? So yeah, there is a little digression into much earlier history there. Because, and this is another thing that a lot of Christians think they know about, that, you know, there's always been this battle between faith and science. And no, there have been conflicts and there have been a lot of points of commonality, and there have been a lot of scientific advances made by people who had what we would recognize as Christian faith, as well as scientific advances made by people who didn't have Christian faith. It's just a much longer and not always combative history.
Yeah. I love that little thing about the Western tradition, which we recovered from the Muslims, you know, the Arabic world. One of the things, another thing you drop in here too, is how the rise of modernism and historical criticism and that bringing science to bear on the scriptures actually changed the way, for instance, Christians read Genesis 1 and 2. In the book, you talk about how, like, for instance, Augustine, it just never occurred to him that this was a literal 7-day creation, right? Those kinds of things. But then you introduce evolution and Darwin, and then historical criticism, and then we are demanding the scriptures answer the challenge of Charles Darwin, and it changes the way we read these texts.
Yes, and you've reminded me of one of the real aha moments for me back in graduate school. We were reading portions of the Scofield Reference Bible on Genesis, and this was the Bible of fundamentalists, and the notes in the Scofield Reference Bible to the days of creation were, well, like, they could have been 24-hour days, but they probably weren't. They were probably much longer than that. And I was like, what? The one thing you know from fundamentalism is that it's literal everything. It's starting with 7-day creation. There'd been a fight about that at Wheaton when I was in undergrad. And I couldn't believe that as late as the Scofield Reference Bible, they're like, there's really a lot of uncertainty here. And that something that I had been taught was clear and changeless. Like, all Christians thought that it was literal 7-day creation until these modernists, until these Darwinians came. And like, no, the quote-unquote conservative side was changing every bit as fast as the supposedly liberal modernist side, trying to figure out, okay, new knowledge is coming online. The debate has shifted. Where are we staking out our territory? And it wasn't just that everybody had read the Bible the same way until suddenly they didn't. And yeah, like, I probably should have figured that out before grad school. I did not. It was a major shift in my own thinking, not just as a scholar, but as a Christian.
I just think it's so freeing for people to learn about that, because you invest so much in being right and conserving what's always been true. And then you realize that the conservers were changing as well in order to try to counter what they felt like was a threat. And so it actually is freeing, I think, Alicia, to understand that. So I just wanted to say thank you for that.
I hope so. In history, we call that contingency. Like, it could have been otherwise. These things happened the way they did for particular reasons in a particular time and place. It's not timeless. It's not inevitable. And it tends to be very disturbing and destabilizing when I will first tell that to students, that these things were contingent. But hopefully they will get to the point of seeing, oh, it could have been otherwise. That means it could be otherwise going forward. There might be other aspects of even my own tradition that I can recover. You can go back to a different point in time and explore a different branch that went off there. There isn't just either the one road I've already been on or like chaos in the world.
Well, you detail some of the cultural and societal pressures that contributed to the heightened tension between religion and science. Can you talk a bit about those, like immigration, prohibition, and how those forces were at play?
Yeah, Scopes Trial is something that I started teaching at my first teaching job, where I was at a small Christian college in southwestern Pennsylvania. There were two of us teaching history. I was all of US, and my colleague was the rest of the world since the dawn of time. And I taught a book on the Scopes trial, Larson, Summer for the Gods, that was offering multiple interpretations, sort of, was this really about rural versus urban? Was this really about sort of heartland versus coastal Northeast? Was this really about native born versus immigrant? Was this about, was there labor unrest? Was there generational, how much is the technological aspect? Automobiles were coming on online then. Like the U.S. population technically shifted from majority rural to majority urban in this time. Urban meaning, I think, anything over 3,000 people. So upland would be urban in that definition. But that helped me and my students there understand, oh, there was so much going on here. And all of that anxiety did not have to attach itself to the teaching of evolution in schools. There had been unrest about that. There had been a lot of ferment in biblical studies, and that was downstream from the divide over the Civil War. If you're going to look at the scriptures holistically, it would be good to know a lot about the historical context of all these different books and the linguistic context and consult a wider range of experts to understand how these things went together. So there was anxiety about what the Bible said and meant and how much expertise did you have to really understand it. But it's fairly unusual that in the United States, because that's going on in other countries too, other Christian places with a large Christian population or a lot of Christians at the universities. It's really in the U.S. where all these anxieties get attached to the teaching of evolution in schools and the idea of schools, high schools. High school was fairly new then. Most Americans didn't ever get that much education. And, you know, this is another thing that we see now when there's a lot of kind of free-floating anxiety, and there are a handful of people who want to mobilize that anxiety and turn it into anger for political ends, they will find some issue, even one that wouldn't seem naturally central. Slavery was naturally central. That's what they were going to fight about in the 19th century. You had other choices in the early 20th century. You have other choices now than, say, trans athletes. But all of that anger and anxiety gets attached to something, and then it blows up.
Mm-hmm. And now, a word from a sponsor.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
You have some stats about the number of immigrants coming into the country that blew up, right? You have some stats about all of the Catholics entering the country and how, you know, I was born German, Irish, Catholic. And so there was a cultural memory in my family, Alicia, about how especially Irish Catholics were seen as drunks and fighters and brawlers. And so you had a predominantly white Protestant country being infiltrated by Italian, Irish immigrants that were mostly Catholic. And there was this fear that they were being replaced, right? And so I love how you talked about how Prohibition was this reaction against what they saw as this, quote, invasion of Catholics into their country as a way to sort of police and sort of contain the worst of that, what they saw invasion. And how much that relates to what we're dealing with today.
Yeah, the political cartoons from that period of a lot of immigration, 1880s to 1920s, before the United States changed its immigration laws and basically just shut it down. 1924, we get quota systems, the first laws saying that certain people are just so different and so dirty. And so potentially disease-ridden, we don't want them here. That starts with laws against Chinese women, and then Chinese and other Asian immigrants. And then those similar ideas will get applied to Southern Europeans, Eastern Europeans, Catholics, Jews, who is so other that we don't want them at all. And we will see their presence among us as an infiltration, as an invasion, as a replacement. A lot of that fight did happen over prohibition in the United States. It's a little bit different when they're fighting over evolution, although there's still strong racial hierarchy, a strong sense that certain people deserve to be here, certain people deserve to have maximum social privileges, and other people don't deserve them, either should never have them or will have to work really hard to earn them. All of that kind of... it's a white supremacy culture, and it was exercised in both prohibition and the anti-evolution hysteria.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's telling, I think, it's telling that Italians and Irish weren't considered white.
At least not white enough. Yeah.
They weren't white enough. Now, they could get into the white club and eventually did people who aren't white, but that's what bred a lot of that fear and resentment. Maybe one last question, just talking about the trial itself. It's often seen as the showdown between secular atheistic modernism and religious fundamentalism. But Brian, who is the pastor that was called upon to defend Christianity, a godless evolution, isn't your standard what you would think of fundamentalist. Tell us a little bit about this guy and why he doesn't really fit what we would think of in 21st century as a fundamentalist.
Yeah, Brian ran for president a whole bunch of times. He espoused some positions that would seem very progressive and some that would seem very conservative. He was a populist. And so in that sense, it's similar to many of the politicians of one of our parties that will say that they're fighting for Christian values, by which they mean small town farming kind of values. Brian was the great commoner. He was that kind of populist. But his ideas about women, his ideas about voting rights, his ideas, some of his economic ideas.
Like labor unions, he was pro-union. Like he almost sounds more like a progressive socialist in some ways than a religious fundamentalist.
In some ways, yeah. And this is another thing that's useful, another thing that I discovered later in life than I should have, and then always make sure that undergrads learn, our political parties have not always been the same, even as long as we've had that they were Republican and Democrat, not going all the way back to the Whigs and the Federalists and whatnot. Those are labels. I've sometimes described them as like, if you've moved a lot, you have boxes that sometimes different things get put in. Those party labels are like boxes that things can get taken out and put in. Positions, constituencies, geographic representation. It isn't always static. And if you go back far enough, you'll find Democrats saying things that sound a lot like today's Republicans, or Republicans saying things that sound a lot like today's Democrats. These ideas get mixed and matched in different ways. So yeah, Brian was not just a sort of country preacher type guy, although in the trial, when against any kind of decent legal practice, Brian gets put on the stand. One of the competing lawyers gets then grilled by the other one because both of these guys really want to have a showdown for the ages. There, Brian does sound like your basic small town preacher, Sunday school guy. And so that image sort of gets set for people. And then they're surprised, oh, wait, he was for women's voting rights and labor, like how does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'm wondering, like, as you guys talk, I'm just curious, because I'm just thinking, like, how this has all impacted today. Like, my kids are in, you know, AP history class, they're learning things or whatever. But part of me is, like, what's going on today has been impacted by these things. There are these enduring legacies here. And so help us understand how, you know, the Methodist split or this trial that we're talking about gives us a better understanding and access to what's going on in our world today.
Yeah, that's a very big question that I'll do whole semesters of teaching on. These particular chapters to focus on, and other chapters in the book are not so much about sort of culture warsy things as these are, for drawing clear lines to where we are now, when you can have populist demagogues whipping up anger about issues that wouldn't otherwise have to be a big deal. Like those lines are a little bit easier to draw maybe than from early contact of missionaries and Native Indigenous people, or the beginning of the Black Church tradition, or some of the other things that are in this book. Mm-hmm. But the idea that there's some sort of culture war, it's fairly regional, it's fairly small town, urban elite. It has to do with who gets to define what Christianity is. Something that bothers me, and it would relate to both of these chapters, the idea that evangelicals are the ones who take the Bible seriously, quote unquote. Well, what you mean there is they take certain verses and use that for their cultural projects. That's not the only way to take the Bible seriously. That's maybe not even a very healthy way to take the Bible seriously. There were other Christians reading it differently. There are still other Christians out there reading it differently. There is not a Christian position on most of these social issues. There was not a Christian position on slavery. You could say theologically, this is what it should have been, but Christians at the time, using the tools available to them, the scriptures, sermons, stuff like that, staked out different positions. I don't know that that's answering your question of how this, I mean, it would be nice if we could look back into U.S. history and say, okay, we've had a conflict like this before. Here's a model of how we solved it. That is mostly not what we find. We see, here's one way that goes really badly.
Right. Yeah. Well, it is interesting because you just think, like, you know, my kids are taking these history classes, but what they could learn in a church history understanding and how that impacts daily life, honestly, like in how people are treated and what people believe and what people say. And in these past, like, it's almost like, unfortunately, in the bones of some people because of what they've learned and taught and now how they live. And so there's part of me that's like, oh, well, we need like a church history class in public school. There, I said it, folks.
There are ways to do some aspects of church history in a straight up U.S. history class. Sure. I've taught both. And a lot of, going back to that question of how do you decide what goes in a book like this? Well, if some event era came up in both a U.S. history survey and a church history survey,
yeah,
those points were ones that I really wanted to drill down on and see how these different big forces in culture were interacting there.
Yeah.
I think one of the, you know, I haven't chimed in till now, but I think one of the things that I'm gleaning from this conversation is that I'm hoping for our listeners that it maybe just gives them a little bit of healthy suspicion when they do hear the sort of the cultural talking points and the ways that these ahistorical or unhistorical assertions are made in order to galvanize, you know, political power or whatever it might be. It just gives them maybe a little bit of a healthy suspicion to go, you know what, maybe that isn't always how everybody read the Bible. Or maybe, you know, maybe this situation isn't as black and white as it seems. Or maybe there is, you know, as you were saying, Alicia, some previous example of a very similar kind of situation that turned out much differently. And so I think it helps people to feel, I hope, not painted into a corner by the rhetoric or the things that their leaders are saying, and sort of like, to be a faithful Christian, you have to X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3. And it paints them into that corner. And I think studying your book and studying these turning points in American church history can help people say, you know what? I don't have to be painted into this corner. We can think about this in a different way, in a new way, in categories that are not being offered to us. And maybe that'll help us be more faithful.
I think that's a really great way to look at it. And some of why I got attracted to the study of church history and decided to make that my career, it was freeing for me. Once I worked through the destabilization, oh, it wasn't always this. Oh, the Bible has this range of meanings. How do I know what is true? How to guide my life anymore? Mm-hmm. That's a totally natural reaction. I certainly see it from students. But to get past that and see there have been multiple paths that are all part of this tradition. There have been multiple voices that are all part of this tradition. If there's some way of being Christian in the world that's really not working for me, there are other options to explore. There are other resources in the tradition. And some of learning about that is learning about what all didn't work well. Yeah. But there are also those voices of people who, against all odds, found their way to faith, who were really brave voices in the past, calling out things that we now recognize were great evils. I have really enjoyed exploring the riches of the tradition, and I hope that that can be a resource for other people as well.
Amen.
Well, Alicia, thank you for writing this book. We only talked about 2 of 13 chapters. Obviously, there's the Azusa Street Revival here. There's election of Ronald Reagan. There's a defeat of the Spanish Armada. So many little moments that are pregnant with, I think, application and meaning for us. And just to say, like, I know many grew up like hating history because it was taught poorly, meaning it was taught at 20,000 feet. And what I love about this book is that you go deep into like really personal, particular stories and then work from the ground up to say, this is what this tells us about America, about the church, and about us at this time. And it just brings black and white, two-dimensional things into color and three dimensions. So thank you for this book. It's titled Turning Points in American Church History, How Pivotal Events Shaped a Nation and a Faith. Alicia, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for this conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, Matt, you love history.
I do.
More than any normal person I know. So, I mean, we didn't get to talk about the other 11 chapters in her book.
Yeah.
But is there one that you wish we could have talked about that you're like, man, that when I read that, that was really good? Just to tease our listeners that there's more to her book because we really only talked just about such a short piece of it.
Yeah. You know, probably the chapter on Ronald Reagan being elected president. I think because of how out of the 1960s and the social fabric being ripped asunder with civil rights laws and women burning bras, you know, and all these things where patriarchy and white supremacy were being overthrown. And then you had sort of this 1970s of people who had functioned within patriarchy and white supremacy sort of being like, did we lose? You know, is that it? And then her chapter on Ronald Reagan and really the galvanization of a religious right, this bringing together of Roman Catholic conservatives and Protestant conservatives and even like Church of the Latter-day Saint conservatives into one galvanized voting block rallied around these icons of what it means to be conservative, right? I think was just fascinating. When I became a Christian, Christy, that none of that was, I wasn't aware of any of that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? To me, the religious right had always existed and it was self-evident and it's just who I was as a Christian. And I think tracing the history of that and how Ronald Reagan sort of embodied that is really helpful to be like, oh, she used the word contingent. This is there were contingencies that brought this to bear, and this is why it makes sense.
Yeah. You know, I don't think I asked it very well in that interview, but what I was trying to get at is that I do think that like our upbringing put in our bones ways of thinking that then when our eyes are opened, it shakes us.
It sure
does. But there's something like I'm hungry for really understanding, really knowing, and not just, I don't mean this in a bad way, but like blindly believing whatever someone says.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm just concerned that sometimes I don't know. I don't know how to word it right, but I think that there were things that I learned as a kid that then just got in me. And now as an adult, I'm like, wait a minute, why do I think that? Yeah. Why do I not question that? Why have I never heard that before? You know, so
totally.
There's more to learn. There's just more to learn.
There is. I totally know what you're talking about. And I think that feels, for the last 4 years, 5 years, I think we've been trying as a podcast to respond to our own questions about that, right? So there's other experts, other people who know more about this than us. Let's go to them and learn together so that we don't have to sort of feel disoriented or don't have to just retreat back into what we've already known, but actually respond as like, these are Kairos moments, and maybe God's at work here in helping us reckon with these kinds of things.
Yeah. 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 Well, I did learn something. do you know where the Declaration of Independence was signed?
Oh no, this is great. I love history. Philadelphia.
At the bottom. Come on, people. I got it.
You do. This was a history joke.
It was a history joke. Come on.
You worked a history joke into our history.
I did a mom joke at the end, and I didn't even mess it up. I will say, like, my heart was pounding a little bit. Like, don't mess it up.
So nervous. Awesome.
All right. Well,
you'll have to wait then another week for another animal that walks into the bar.
Oh, that's okay. I can wait another week. All right. Well, listeners, have a great week. We'll see you next time.
See you next time. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.